Good evening. I'm Catherine Loper, news director at WRVO Public Media. We are pleased to bring you the sixth in a series of community forums on health topics, sponsored by the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. Today we are at Tompkins County Public Library in Ithaca, and our topic is elder care. As the baby boomer generation ages and people live longer, communities are considering how to accommodate their growing elderly populations, and individuals are contemplating all the various ways they themselves should prepare for their senior years, or what their parents or other loved ones need to be cared for as they get older. Financial advisors encourage people of all ages to save money for retirement, but what other kinds of planning should be considered? Where will you live? What kind of health care and personal assistance will you need? And what about transportation or legal directives that you need to make? And possibly most importantly, what do you need to do to ensure a happy life emotionally and socially as you adjust to the physical limitations of aging? Many communities in upstate New York have larger proportions of seniors than some other regions as younger people move away, so these issues have even a greater impact here. Are governments prepared to cope with the impact of the growing elderly population? And what should elected officials, community organizations, and nonprofits be doing right now to get ready? We will discuss both the societal and personal impacts of the needs for elder care with our three expert panelists, who I'm very pleased to introduce. Dr. Carl Pillemer is a professor in human development and gerontology and medicine at the Weill Cornell Medical College. He is an internationally renowned gerontologist directing the Cornell Legacy Project, and he is the author of the book 30 Lessons for Living, Tried and True Advice from the Wisest Americans. And he has a new book coming out soon, 30 Lessons for Loving. Martha Stintinius is the author of a book and a caregiver advocate. She wrote her critically acclaimed book, Inside the Dementia Epidemic, A Daughter's Memoir, about her experience being the primary care provider for her mother. She speaks and consults widely on caregiver issues. And Dr. Bill Thomas is a physician, author, and healthcare provider. An international authority on elder care, he is best known for his healthcare system innovation and as the founder of the global nonprofit, The Eden Alternative, which works to improve the care provided to older people. He is the creator of The Greenhouse, a new approach to long-term care for seniors, and he also developed the senior ER model of care for hospitals. And so I thank you all for joining me. We've got a great expertise here. It's a big topic, and it's a very personal topic about how to prepare our communities and ourselves for that aging process. So I just wanted to start by asking each of you to describe sort of in general how you think our communities here are currently prepared to accommodate the needs of this senior population that I described as growing. Dr. Pillemer, I'll start with you.
You know, I think we can look at what we're doing here locally, but it also has to be taken in a national context. In general, we aren't well prepared. And I think, as one of my colleagues here will probably talk about, for example, we are currently looking at an absolute epidemic of Alzheimer's disease that neither our political leaders or anyone else is actively confronting. We live in one of the most age-segregated societies in human history, where the connections between the generations are getting more and more tenuous, and we live in a society that's highly ambivalent about aging and goes wildly between very positive and extremely negative views of old people, but that basically views old age as a time for sick care and very little else. Locally, I think there are some positive aspects of what's going on in Central New York. I think there are communities that are becoming increasingly age-friendly. I'm most familiar here with Ithaca, but I know those kinds of activities are going on elsewhere. The final thing I'll say is that we have specific issues in that we're a rural environment which raises its own transportation and delivery of service and social support issues. So I'd say, in general, we aren't prepared. Locally, we may be a bit better prepared than some other places because of some of the work that's going on right now.
And Martha?
Yeah, I'd agree with everything that Carl just said. I was a caregiver for my mother for 8 years here in upstate New York, and my view is what I learned as a caregiver and also what I've learned doing research for the two blogs I write for caregivers and the book that I wrote. So my impression, I'm not a doctor or a geriatric social worker or an other healthcare professional, but my opinion is that we are not prepared. We don't think about long-term care in particular until we're in the middle of it. It's kind of like taking care of your adolescents. You may read some books about it, but you don't really know what you're going to encounter until you're in the middle of caring for your teenager. Same thing with caring for an elderly spouse or partner or a parent or other family member. It's not something we want to think about until we're in the middle of it, I don't think. Also, there's the fact that many of us are living longer, the boomers are aging. 100 years ago, most people in their 50s did not have a parent who was still alive. Now, if you're between the ages of 60 and 74, you're likely to have a parent who's still living. So we see people in their 60s and 70s caring for parents in their 80s and 90s. That's a huge demographic shift, and our social support systems like Social Security have not caught up with that.
And Dr. Thomas?
Well, I think the most important thing from my point of view is that aging is a virtue, it's a strength, it's an endowment. We are being gifted with an extraordinary phase of life, which, as Martha was saying, was denied to many people in earlier generations. And perhaps the most distressing thing from my point of view is that we often have rhetoric about the calamity of aging, when it actually represents, on a world historical level, one of the greatest human successes in history. We have done something no other people has ever done before, and that has made aging a mass phenomenon, made it available to millions of people. And we've got some work to do to figure out how to make the best of a wonderful victory.
And you bring up a good point. Because of the advances in medical care, that's why we have this growing population, which, you know, we're describing here as sort of an issue, but it is a gift, and it is something that's also very personal. We all here either are thinking about our own aging or have dealt with parents, and all of you in the audience probably as well. So, and everyone has a different journey, and it depends on where you live and what your situation is. But as Martha said, you know, you don't exactly know how to prepare for it because you don't know when it's going to hit or what the issue is going to be. So speaking from the personal side, what do you think individuals and their families are doing now and aren't doing now to prepare for the needs of their family members or themselves as they get older? Carl?
Right, and I absolutely agree with Bill that we have this longevity bonus, and the question is how we're going to use it. And I think that planning is a real part of that. If you look at the research, people tend not to like to plan for unpleasant things in the future. There have been advances made in preparing for the end of life. So people now are more likely to do end-of-life planning and living wills. There is absolutely no, or at least a very little interest in people in chronic disease planning, which is what is going to affect a lot of people. And there's very little planning in the family context as well. So people rarely talk with their children, for example, about allocating care and who they expect to have care from and that sort of thing. You know, I think that this is also indicated by people's failure to be interested in things like long-term care insurance. It seems too much of a remote possibility for people to do this kind of planning. So I think that we need to help people to do this. There need to be better tools and better options available for people to think about the whole course of life. I think that a problem with younger people is that their view of old age is much too short. That people have an image in their 30s and 40s of the end at 60 or 70, not realizing that they may still have left as much time as they had, say, in the workforce. So I think there's this much longer time span needed in which people think about having to need your body for 100 years and to figure out these aspects in the last 25 or so years of life. And it's hard to get people to be realistic about that.
And Martha?
I think that a lot of people don't think they're going to need a lot of long-term care because we hear about aging well and people in their 70s running marathons, and that's wonderful. But the reality is that most of us will need long-term care. Women are twice as likely to need long-term care than men for 5 years or more. And 70% of people age 65 and older will need long-term care for at least a year. So I think when we're educating ourselves and talking to our family members, yes, we definitely need to talk to them about what their preferences might be if they need long-term care. Do they want to stay at home no matter what? Are they open to assisted living or nursing home care? you know, what are their preferences for the end of life? When my mother was in her mid-50s, early 60s, and I was in my 20s, early 30s, she researched end-of-life issues. She was a planner and a reader, and she wanted to know what her own preferences would be, and she wrote them down, and she gave them to me at about age 60. Now, she didn't need to move in with me and receive long-term care until she was 72, but I knew what her preferences were. Later, when her dementia progressed and she couldn't help make decisions, I knew, for example, in the nursing home that she would not want a feeding tube inserted. So that helped relieve some of my anxiety as a caregiver. So those conversations should come early and often, even though they can be difficult to initiate. Also, planning should include going to an elder care attorney, working out a living will, a durable power of attorney, a healthcare proxy, find an attorney who knows elder care issues, maybe even a financial planner who knows about elder care issues. I wish I had gone to a financial planner. We lost about $60,000 because of an error I made when I applied for Medicaid for my mother the last 2 years of her life. So we definitely need to plan ahead in that way. Unfortunately, people don't know what long-term care involves, right? It can be anything from cooking and cleaning and shopping to bathing, dressing, toileting, and feeding someone. There's a long range. For people with Alzheimer's and other dementias, it can last up to 20 years and deplete your hard-earned savings, which is what happened with my mother. She ran out of savings 2 years before she died. She was a teacher, and she pinched every penny. She probably had more savings than many people do, but it didn't last the number of years that she needed it.
Generally, Bill, if you would answer that question as well, of what are some of the things you think individuals need to think of versus, you know, our society as a whole?
I think an important thing is for people to be able to look in the mirror and see the face staring back at you and know that that is your face. And that's exactly the face you're supposed to have. And it's right and it's good. And that aging doesn't represent some kind of loss, but rather the development of a different way of being, different capacities, new limitations, new strengths, and to identify oneself really fully with the person you're becoming. Pediatricians are often very excited about seeing their child patients grow up to adulthood. As a geriatrician, I'm excited about seeing patients grow into elderhood. That from my point of view, there is a very, very rich and meaningful life beyond adulthood. But our culture, of course, obscures that and makes it difficult for us to take hold of that. And I find that the best place to begin really is in front of a mirror.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a community health forum on WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper, WRVO News Director. Today we are discussing issues surrounding the care of senior citizens. And Carl, you wanted to add something to that, right, of what individuals need to think about.
We're doing a very large study in which we are tracking whole families with two older parents and all of their adult children over a long period of time. And the one thing we find is one thing that families don't do is highly specifically talk about the nature of care distribution. For example, we found that if an older mother gets as her caregiver the child she hopes will be her caregiver, she's much less depressed, is much happier about the care experience. And we also found then if the kids are talking about how they themselves plan to think about their own responsibilities. And I'm curious if Martha agrees, but I think that people to some extent are even more likely to talk about housing preferences or choices or long-term care than, you know, among Billy, Bobby, and Betty, I really would like Betty to, you know, care for me and under these circumstances. So I think the people who work with older people and family themselves prior to the crisis that causes a need for care ought to talk about the family division of responsibilities. I think for anyone who's been through it, conflicts around that cause such an enormous amount of stress and pain and anxiety that anticipating them is really helpful.
Well, let's start there. I want to get to some brass tacks. So let's start with the family conversation or that looking in the mirror. You know, when you need to talk to your children about this, when should you talk to them? And I think you bring up a very good point, but some of those things, you know, are very situational. The child you may want to care for you may live 3,000 miles away and you're stuck with the one who lives, you know, down the road. you know, not stuck with, but that's who you're left with. Martha, what would you say? I mean, when do you have that conversation, and what are the things you actually need to talk about when it comes to how you will divide up the labor amongst your children, who will do what, and let them know what you need help with?
Well, unfortunately or fortunately, I didn't have to deal with siblings. It was just me, because my brother had passed away a couple years before Mom moved in with us. So it was just me. I didn't have to deal with sibling conflict, which I know is really common.
But it's a conversation you have to have, right, Bill?
Yeah, actually, I think there's a conversation before the conversation.
Okay.
And one of the things that I believe that American society has gotten wrong in this area is this notion that there's a caregiver. Singular, and that the brothers who live out of town, you know, will send a card now and then, or whatever it is. It can vary according to the family, as Martha was saying. But in fact, care is a partnership. Care is an act that is encountered and carried out by a group of people, not one person. And so a lot of what you read about, and I'm sure Carl's research is diving deep into this, is what happens to the person who gets the short stick, I'm speaking metaphorically, and finds out they're the caregiver. And what we need instead of that, this is the conversation before the conversation, is how do we all contribute to the well-being of someone we love very much? How do we ensure that we all stay healthy, that we all are able to pursue parts of our life that are not related to care, and we're able to be enriched in other ways? And as you were mentioning, it's a conversation that leads you to that path or doesn't. And here's what happens when you don't have the conversation, is it defaults to the American one-on-one, you're the caregiver conversation, and that's not healthy for the elder or the person who's in that role.
Right, because I think we think of caregiver as that person who's right there. But as you said, there are different roles that people in the family or, you know, the social group can play, mm-hmm. whether that's, you know, research or emotional support or mm-hmm. doing the finances, which now you can do from 3,000 miles away. You know, there's a lot of different ways you can look at it. I want to focus a little bit on housing, which I know is a great interest. But I think some of the other issues that seniors have to deal with start with housing, because what kind of housing you have determines your transportation needs, your medical care needs, your personal care needs, and that sort of thing. So, Bill, we could start with you because I know you've worked a lot on this issue.
Sure.
About the different kinds of options from aging in place to retirement homes of different gradation levels, and what are the things to consider here?
First thing I'll say is I know that 97% of Americans agree it's best to remain in your own home. And what's wrong with the other 3%? I don't know. But I find that when 97% of people agree, it's probably wrong. And it is wrong in this case. Being in that home that you've lived in for 40 years might be the right thing for you, or it might not. The problem is, in American society, if you make a decision to leave your home, it is ascribed as a failure and that you're on a downward slope and that's it, it's over. And so people right here in our community actually are living alone and lonely lives, isolated, bored, cut off from the community, because they believe that the only victory is possible is to stay in that house. And so I know these guys will have important things to say about this, but I would just conclude by saying you need to think about aging in community, not aging in place. Aging is a team sport. And if you want to play and you want to win, you've got to be with people. And aging in place often, too often, makes that impossible.
Carl?
I would like to tape record Bill's comments and then lip sync them at other occasions. Because I could not agree more. In the interviews that we've done around older people's advice for living, one of the strongest ones, and let me say I have no ties economically to the assisted or senior living industry at all, is how many of them argued that people ought to consider more of a communal living situation and not be bound to this sort of American ideal of having to age in place in your own large home. And we've done other studies showing that people are very worried about issues like privacy, for example, prior to moving into a group situation. A lot of those disappear. Actually, after they move, for a lot of people, group settings can help overcome problems of social isolation, can improve mobility, and that sort of thing. The only friendly amendment I'd offer is that we need those locations way more centrally located. Mm-hmm. We need them where it's walkable, where people can really be a part of downtowns. And that's happening a little bit, as some of you may know, about the Age-Friendly Cities Initiative, is trying to create these kind of age-friendly communities. My mother lived in Maine, and you would drive down a road, and in every single farmhouse had one older woman living in it by herself. It wasn't optimal. And I think he's absolutely right that we have to think of different kind of ways that the people can live together for more optimal aging.
And Martha?
Yeah, I definitely agree that we need to look at aging in community instead of aging in place. There's a big movement now with boomers to age in community. And to me, that means while you're still well and able to help other people, is to build networks among your friends and family and help other people in your community. Even if you're living in an assisted living facility, that's a type of community. Help them while you're able to, and then when you need care or assistance, other people can help you. That's how I look at aging in community. We are all vulnerable. We all need assistance. I look at it as interdependence rather than independence.
You're listening to a community health forum on WRVO Public Media. We are discussing the issue of caring for senior citizens. I'm joined by our panel of experts, gerontologist Carl Pillemer of Cornell University, Bill Thomas, physician, author, and innovator, and Martha Stintinius, caregiver, advocate, and author. And we were just discussing the housing options for seniors, and there seems to be a consensus among the panelists that community is important, but my job is to play devil's advocate. And not everyone can afford to move into a retirement community. Sometimes that's more expensive an option. Some people live in places where there aren't a lot of options for community. What are the options if you don't have anything nearby or you can't afford it, Bill?
Well, I'll just say this is, I think, one of the things that we're all talking about, aging in community. Economically, it might mean that you wind up staying in this house, but we as a society and a culture need to keep elders connected to us. And this is often interpreted as a kind of charity. Oh, you know, old people, we got to do things for them because they could get lonely. Wrong. We need them. We're in danger of becoming the first society to experiment with the radical project of young people growing to adulthood without regular contact with elders. And I have to tell you, there's the university that Carl works with. I gave a lecture there a couple of years ago and asked the group of students, how many of you grew up with close contact with an older person? I had about 40 students in the room. No hands went up. So imagine this, 40 young adults, none of whom had an older person in their life when they were younger children. And that, to me, was like an alarm bell going off. So pushing back on what you're saying, we need to make options, and it isn't a matter of charity on behalf of older people. It's because we need elders in our communities. We need them talking to us, being with us, and influencing us.
And Dr. Pillemer, your book's on the wisdom of elders, so you probably have something to...
I just want to say, on the flip side to what Bill said, that there was a recent study showing that if people age 65 and older, around 25% have had a meaningful conversation with someone under 35 in the past month, and if you take out their family members, it goes down to 6%. So that we are in the most age-segregated society, I absolutely agree. And I think we do need these different models of community building. An obvious answer is absolutely that the one problem with assisted living and senior living is that it has these economic limits and that it's not open to people often who are of lower income. The obvious answer to that is to create lower income alternatives for people that are good and meaningful and supported and integrated. I always hate to let government off the hook, but I will say there are important voluntary initiatives like time banks, which people can pay into as they age and then draw back from when they actually need it. There's a concept called the village concept, which is now starting in a number of places. It's actually starting up a little locally, talking about it, which keep people in their own homes but in community. It's really a two-pronged thing, and one is to make these options more affordable And the other one is, as Bill was suggesting, to build community into people's current living spaces through these more voluntary approaches.
Right. I read an article in the LA Times within the last year about seniors who couldn't afford to move to a community, so they, you know, invited roommates in who were elders, and I don't mean to make it sound like the Golden Girls, but the concept is to create that community if you can't move to one yourself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Martha, for many folks, the option is really moving in with children or children moving in with parents, and that brings a lot of issues with it as well. What do people need to consider before doing that? Because it alters the life of both parties.
If you're considering moving a parent into your home, step back for a little bit and really, really think about it, because it's going to affect everyone in the household in positive ways, yes, but also there are going to be a lot of challenges. I found it really helpful to go to my county office for the aging. I think that's a terrific resource for family caregivers at home that helped me think through all the issues of having my mom live with me and my husband and our two elementary age children. This was 9 years ago. And to think about what other options might work for us as a family, not just for my mother and not just for me, but for everyone. Everyone's needs are important. I think what often gets lost in the conversation about elder care is that the care partner or the caregiver, the care partner is equally as important as the person receiving care. And I could talk more about care partnerships where you both help each other and you both share affection and you're both giving each other things that are very valuable. But as far as caring for someone in your home, perhaps hire a geriatric care manager. I know it sounds expensive and it's something that I did not do, but I wish I had done it. For $50 to $200 an hour, you can hire a geriatric care manager, and they can come in and assess your situation in your home, give you recommendations for your family that would work for you, tell you what resources are available in your community, and come up with a care plan. Now, I wish I had invested that money. I know it sounds very expensive, but looking back, we had to spend down all of my mother's savings before she'd qualify for Medicaid, so I should have just spent this money to get professional guidance. Now, another option for finding that guidance is your office for the aging. You can get free caregiver counseling, go to a caregiver support group, and find what services are available in your community to help you if you don't have the option of putting your loved one in a quality care facility. There's respite services, and there are other things in your community that can help you as a caregiver.
Okay, so we've considered housing and different options, and obviously the sort of societal, emotional, social aspect of that. But what other things do you need to consider once you've figured out, okay, this is where I think I'm going to live? What other things need to come into that conversation? Transportation, nearby health care, other services that are nearby? What should people be thinking of?
Yeah, I think in a county like ours, in an area like ours, transportation has to come high on the list. It's extremely isolating for people in rural environments to get anywhere because of transportation difficulties. It's less than half of communities have any kind of a dial-a-ride program or some kind of flexible transportation. So, you know, again, one answer to that is the creation of living settings that are more centrally located. But the other is expanding both governmentally provided transportation and volunteer transportation. I think that people don't anticipate how isolating a move to a non-driver status is going to be. And that needs to be a very careful decision and bound up with housing. I think in terms of healthcare accessibility and so forth, older people are more insulated against devastating healthcare expenses to some extent because of their participation in the Medicare program, which, by the way, in my opinion, is getting better because of the Affordable Care Act. So that, you know, there's less of a regional difference in that as long as they're a good provider. So I think people have to consider housing options, transportation options. I would also add a more ineffable sense of the vibrancy of the community, of its welcomingness, if that's a word, of the kind of recreational and other opportunities that are available. I think that's really part of people making a decision on that score.
And that's very individual and personal. And Bill, we touched on this, but in a rural community, which so many places around here are, you know, what are the special considerations when you're deciding? Because for some people, you know, it's hard to move to a new community. Some people are individually, you know, suited to that because they're good at making new friends. But some people, after living in one community for 40 years, that's not good for them. What do you think?
Well, I actually want to first off say I think, you know, Carl's approach of talking to elders and finding out what they know, I think is brilliant. I love it. And we were chatting before. I spent this spring traveling around the country talking to elders, among other things. And I had a piece of advice given to me by an elder that I think really applies here. She was talking about the danger of being isolated socially as one enters in later decades of life. And she said that she had always thought of her life and the people in her life and her friends as being in a funnel. And no matter what age you are, but especially when you're older, there's people falling out of the bottom of the funnel. Bob, who I used to golf with, not here anymore. Maybe he moved to Florida. Maybe he passed away. And that process accelerates. And that what she learned about growing old was you have to keep putting new people in the top of the funnel.
Very true.
If you stop doing that and you don't do anything else, the funnel's going to get empty. And that, you know, you mentioned rural, and I brought it up because this is maybe even especially important in a rural community where you can't simply rely on the people you've known for a long, long time. We have to have new people coming into our lives. So this last point I make is an image Carl had of his mom living on a kind of remote, isolating road. That's culture. That's society. And that is not the future of aging. And I'm sorry that those elders had that experience. But our rural communities, every one of the little downtowns, if you want to call them that, villages, could benefit from elders moving in off the farm into that village. And if we can make that happen, the village gets stronger and those elders get to fill the funnel.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a community health forum on WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper, WRVO News Director. Today we are discussing issues surrounding the care of senior citizens. And that brings me to a topic of technology, and I don't know how much you all can talk about how this might change things in healthcare, in delivering different services to seniors as we become more technological, more, you know, internet savvy, and what you could speak of towards how this might help or hurt in the future. Anyone want to? Yes, Martha.
So my mom lived alone in a cottage on Seneca Lake for 25 years. Now, looking back, I wish there had been some types of technology I could have used to keep track of how she was doing, because she was very proud and didn't want to worry me. She didn't call me and tell me that things weren't going well, but I learned that the dementia had progressed to the point where she really needed more care and she couldn't live alone. There are some things I've heard about now that would have been really helpful back then. For example, there is a technology called EverMind, where you plug a little box into their appliance that they use all the time, like their TV or their coffee maker or their lamp on their bedside table. You plug in this little wireless remote device, and it tells you through text or email whether your loved one who lives far away from you is up in the morning doing their normal routine or not, and it lets you know if they're not turning on the coffee maker or the TV or the lamp. My mom probably would have let me use that. Maybe she wouldn't have, but I think she would have appreciated the practicality of it and let me try it out since I was an hour away. And she lived where neighbors in the winter simply weren't there. There was one neighbor in the winter. She lived at the bottom of this steep shale road where she had to hike up the road in the winter to get to where she parked her car. She could not drive down to her cottage. It was very remote. And so technology can help when your loved one lives far away. Other things are tracking devices for people who have dementia and wander. It's a huge issue. Medical alert systems that you can wear as a wristband or a pendant, and they can press the button if they need help. Some elders are learning about Skyping so they can keep in touch with their family members across the country. And of course, if they have internet access, which many people in rural communities up here do not, they can join support groups on Facebook. I moderate a Facebook support group called U.S. Against Alzheimer's Community, where you can get advice and support from other people who are facing what you're facing. So there's also, I want to mention one other group online. It's called Dementia Mentors for people who are newly diagnosed with dementia and are living with the early stages of dementia. They can go to this website and meet other people who are living with dementia who can coach them through phone calls and answer their questions. That's a wonderful source that's only online using technology called Dementia Mentors.
Bill or Carl, I'm sure that there's a lot of things that we can't even imagine that are going to maybe help or maybe not.
I'm very excited about cyborgs. A lot of people listening to the program are cyborgs, and it's not just for science fiction. It's actually a human being that has some kind of technology implanted in them to help them. So for some people who have intraocular lenses or an artificial hip or a pacemaker, it turns out that there's a really bright future for using technology and machinery to help us cope with some of the medical and biological difficulties of aging, and I think it's going to get better and better.
Yeah, actually, I think both Bill and Martha have covered a lot of what I would add, that there are these two dimensions. One is technology to actually improve or the physical well-being of people or to solve health-related problems, and that is absolutely exploding, I think, and a lot of the news there is great. I think the only cautionary statement I would add is understanding what the limits of technology are and where, in terms of elder care and older people's services, we actually need high touch rather than high tech. And sometimes that boundary can blur. And so that's my only personal caution. But I agree, I think we're entering a world where there's tremendous potential to solve a lot of problems of aging through some of these technologies.
And the technologies are tools, but nothing can get rid of the caregiver. Now, we've talked about a lot as children as caregivers, but a lot of senior citizens are caregivers themselves to their spouses or partners or siblings, and that can be very isolating as well. You talked about, you know, having to put more people in the funnel. Well, if you're spending all your time caring for your, you know, partner who has a disease or dementia or whatever, that can be very isolating. And so are there any special considerations you would say for those elders who are caregivers themselves of what they should be wary of and be mindful of?
Well, one thing we have to keep in mind, too, and I think you actually find this in studies, especially of older spouses, mm-hmm. is that the caregiving process isn't unremittingly negative. That for a lot of people, it's the fulfillment of a lifelong commitment. It gives people a sense of self-esteem. So they're actually, the more recent research on caregiving isn't quite as bleak in that people do find it a fulfilling, sort of powerful part of what it is to be human sort of experience. I think it's so mitigated by the kinds of supports, especially for older spouses. Mm-hmm. Coming back to, I think, what seems to be a point on the panel of a caring community surrounding them. The only other point I would make about that is a slightly more global one. Things are really going to change in this aging family world. Spouses caring for one another who are in their late 70s and beyond had the largest group of children of almost any group in American history. They have three or four living children or more. As the boomers enter old age, they are much more likely to get there unmarried and with zero, one, or two children. And so what's working now in terms of family support is not likely to keep on working in about, you know, 10 or 15 years. So we have to think of what's going to replace that more vast kind of family support that involved largely intact marriages and lots of kids.
Well, that's where community is
yeah,
actually,
have to come
in, right?
I'll just add to that. Members of the baby boom generation, whether they like it or not, are going to spend more of their old age in the company of people to whom they are not related than any other generation in the history of the world. It is a gigantic experiment that's never been tried before. And the one thing we know, though I think the saving grace in all of this, is that human beings are actually community-making creatures. We know how to do it. We welcome it. We're skillful at it. And I think as the great era of family caregiving doesn't disappear, but as it wanes, we're going to see a new era of intentional family, intentional community, people choosing to affiliate and associate and come into community with each other out of some pretty important and vital and unmet needs, But it's going to be a whole new terrain with new language, new need for public policy, new need for different kinds of support. And actually, to tell you the truth, I'm kind of excited about it.
You're listening to a Community Health Forum on WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper, News Director at WRVO Public Media. We are discussing the issue of caring for senior citizens. I'm joined by our panel of experts, gerontologist Carl Pillemer of Cornell University, Bill Thomas, physician, author, and innovator, and Martha Stantinius, caregiver, advocate, and author. And, Bill, you were just making a very good point about how the baby boom generation, and Carl was as well, is going to be faced with their elder years, maybe without children or one child and fewer familial resources. And that just brings up an interesting topic because our society is completely designed around that nuclear family. And I think possibly a lot, as you mentioned, a lot of societal things, whether it's tax policy or, you know, housing situations are going to have to adapt to that. Yes, Martha.
Yeah, there's a real challenge because spouses and partners who are taking care of a loved one often feel like they need to do it all themselves. It's almost an extension of what they've been doing their whole life to help take care of their partner or spouse. They are unfortunately less likely to ask for help until their own health is affected and they're getting to the burnout phase. I think offices for the aging see that a lot, where the people who come to their support groups, spouses and partners have been care partners for many years before they reach out for help. I just heard a study recently that said that 58% of spousal caregivers, and by that they meant spouses and partners, spousal caregivers, 58% have no help whatsoever in the home. No family members, no friends, no home care aides, no healthcare professionals coming in to help them. They do it alone 24/7. Yes, it can be rewarding, but it's also extremely stressful. Family caregiver is a growing national health crisis. One in three people are caregivers. 60% of caregivers feel extreme stress. It's a health issue for the caregivers. Now, among adult children caring for parents, only 20% have no help at home. So a big difference between 58% and 20%.
Did either of you want to add to that about what society might need to do to help the situation with fewer nuclear families?
I would like to add that we need to change our social safety nets to reflect changes in demographics. For example, there is a bill in the House of Representatives called the Social Security Caregiver Credit Act. It was just introduced in July by one of our representatives in the southern part of New York State. It would give Social Security credit to family caregivers who care for a loved one at home for at least 80 hours a month. When they provide care to someone who needs assistance or supervision and help with activities of daily living, which is things like bathing and dressing and feeding, toileting, someone who's left their paid employment in order to provide care for free at home, this would give them credit in their Social Security for the work that they are doing, for the income that they have lost. This is a huge bill. It's in the House of Representatives. Unfortunately, there is no sister companion bill in the Senate, but please contact your representatives if you favor the bill and let them know.
You know, I think another piece of this problem, and I know it's one that Bill has worked on especially extensively, is if we aren't going to be able to be cared for always by our loved ones, then we're reliant on a geriatric workforce, which by every estimate and every federal report is not only not growing, it's shrinking. There's a great need for geriatricians all around. Try in most communities, for example, to get a comprehensive geriatric assessment by a board-certified geriatrician, and you'll see what I mean. But it stretches much further down into the frontline direct care workers who provide care that families can't. I mean, this is a highly disenfranchised, unempowered workforce that still is often paid barely above the minimum wage, given sometimes only 2 or 3 weeks of training, and into whose hands that we place the most frail and at-risk people in our society. There really needs to be local, state, and national attention to developing and creating this kind of a long-term care and helping workforce. I'll just give one example. In Germany, I was talking about our studies of certified nursing assistants in nursing homes. And no one could get their mind around it because people have 2 full years of training before they even interact with an old person in a nursing home, even at the CNA type level. I know we're like listing all the mounting problems, but unless we can reconceptualize this kind of work as incredibly valuable and well-paid care work, I think there's going to be a lot of trouble for all of us.
As we're wrapping up, I'd like to spend the last little bit talking about what you all have alluded to as sort of the most important thing, is to how to make your senior years happy, productive, because there are, as one of you mentioned, or more of you mentioned, there may be many more years spent as seniors than we are planning. So what are the things you should think of as we think of all these logistical things for, you know, caring for yourself emotionally and being productive? Bill?
Actually, I think the first thing is to not concentrate on being productive. I think one of the traps that older people are snared in our society is that the only good old person is an old person who can stay in the harness and pull. And that's not the function of old age in human history and human community. Really, through most of human history, elders have served to lay a restraining hand on the shoulders of adults who are getting a little carried away. And I think some of the problems we have in American society today is that we actually do live in a society governed by adults without elder supervision. So I'd like actually to see a different vision of old age and elderhood that is really dedicated much more to beingness than doingness. So it always makes me a little nervous when I talk to an older person who wants to persuade me of how busy they are, because what that means is they're on the treadmill, and I know from experience you can't stay on the treadmill forever. So falling off is defined as a failure. But that'd be the first thing I would say, is embrace the role of elder. Stop being an adult. Start growing into the true self you were meant to be.
It sounds like being an elder can be productive in society. Being busy.
I would say be influential.
Influential, that's a better word. And Martha?
Yeah, I totally agree with Bill. One thing that I learned from my mother was to be more in the moment. Because when you're middle-aged, you have a job, you have children, maybe you're trying to save for retirement, your kids' college education, you're running, running, running. And one thing that my mother taught me, even with advanced dementia, was that it's okay to slow down, just be in the moment and enjoy whatever small pleasure you can find in the moment, whether it's a beautiful garden or music or holding hands. And I'm not trying to portray dementia as something rosy all the time, but there, and certainly old age does not equal dementia, but for many people it does, unfortunately, old age. But there are many, many gifts, and I try to remember what I learned from my time with my mother and keep it as part of my life in middle age now, and just take it with me from day to day, what I learned from her.
And Carl, this is central to your research.
It is. I would say, you know, I think as others have mentioned, we have to get over the terror and the fear of aging, the gerontophobia. There are studies which even show that people with more positive attitudes towards aging live longer and live healthier. So I think changing our attitudes towards aging is this more positive and interesting time of life, I completely agree with. I think from our studies of older people, unless someone is really severely disabled, old age is a lot better than people think it's going to be. Even for very old people, it's a time of new beginnings and new challenges, and that's what a lot of the people in our studies have told us. So I think, you know, that is also true. I think, you know, the one thing which I've heard from older people, again and again, touches on something I said earlier. There's a cartoon in The New Yorker of the Manhattanite's view of the world. It's famous. And it goes from the center of New York City to the Hudson River, and then the next stop is California. But that's how people in their 20s through 40s view age 60 or 65, that things end there, and then there's something else that happens. I think if we can change that, you know, notion, because they're going to live longer with their kids as adults than when their kids were in the household. they're probably going to be in a post-retirement or semi-retirement phase longer than they were in the workforce. There's got to be, as I think the other panelists have been saying, a reconceptualization of what this like whole large section of life is. And I think we're getting there slowly but surely. The question is, can we get there fast enough?
Fast enough for everyone. All right, I'd like to open up the forum to questions from the audience. If you have a question, please step forward to the microphone here, identify yourself, and let us know if you want to address your question to a particular panelist or to the panel as a whole. Anyone have a question? Please feel free.
Hi, and thank you very much for wonderful discussion. I had actually two brief things. When Martha was talking about her mother's experience and her mother spending down to, penury, basically. And then our society does step in with Medicaid, of course. I completely agree with this as being an obvious phenomenon of our times, but I see it as part of a broader picture, and I'd like to know all of your thinking about that. The broader picture being an effort at wealth transfer from both the poor and the middle class away from both groups to ultimately leave everyone, except, if you will, the 1%, in the same boat. And if you agree with that, where do we go with that? Because this is an enormous crisis as well as a scandal. The other thing I just wanted to mention was in terms of transportation issue, you didn't really bring in specific medical transportation. And in a place like Ithaca, we have obviously local medical services, but often people need more advanced or specialized medical services in fairly remote communities, Syracuse, Rochester, Sayre in Pennsylvania. And getting there, getting to these places, it's very easy for physicians to refer patients. Their work is done. Then people have to step in, and many people have huge problems with arranging transportation to anywhere but, let's say, getting into town. And even that can be a problem for some people. Where can we go with that issue? Last week's Ithaca Times had an article about apparently the imminent disbanding of Tioga Transport, which is a wonderful system that also covers Tompkins County and goes into Pennsylvania and will be leave many people desolate. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I can speak to the Medicaid question. One thing that I feel very strongly about is that we need public long-term care insurance, because our Medicaid program is now the default public long-term care insurance program. It was designed in the 60s to help take care of women and children. It's now our program for elder care, and you have to become impoverished to qualify for Medicaid. In New York State, you're allowed to keep about $14,000 of your savings until you die, and that money goes to Medicaid. But you're allowed to keep only $14,000. And then you qualify for Medicaid, and you can go to a nursing home. But if we had a public long-term care insurance program like Germany has, the Netherlands, South Korea, Japan, we would each put a little bit of our paycheck into the long-term care insurance program like we do for Medicare. Every working person would contribute a tiny portion, and then when they're ready to use it, they'd have the option of bringing in home care aides or using an assisted living facility or a nursing home or paying themselves to provide care if they're a family member. One reason we have a crisis with caregiving and elder care is because, in my humble opinion, is that we don't have a public long-term care insurance program. We did with the CLASS Act, which was part of the Affordable Care Act, but the CLASS Act was chopped because it was believed to be non-viable. It was non-viable because it was not mandatory. It was voluntary. So how many young people are going to want to have part of their paycheck put into a public long-term care insurance program? Not very many. So that's my spiel on that. Medicaid is going to go bankrupt because we don't have public long-term care insurance.
Neither of you want to weigh in on that, or?
I emphasize, I travel a good bit, spend a lot of time in Europe, and if you want to get the folks at dinner going, you just describe to them how Medicaid works for older people, and they can't, they're like, "This, what country are you talking about? That cannot be America." So we can do better, and your specific advice, I think, was very good. In terms of the medical issue, I actually see, for all people of all ages, a pretty bright future for remote consultation with specialists using telemedicine. I actually used to be a skeptic on this, but have been seeing more and more that I think that technology is really coming together. And if you, what you lose from that face-to-face interaction, you're also not driving 120 miles with a painful condition and sitting in a waiting room for, you know, 2.5 hours. It's I think the trade-offs are good, and we should be seeing a lot more of it.
Did you want to weigh in, Carl?
On no.
Either of those? Okay. Yes.
No, thank you very much for this. My name is Ray Stiefel. I live here in Ithaca, and I appreciate your thoughts about the importance of weighing a balance between being and doing. Do you have any thoughts about people, and it's different for people of different ages, but creating a balance of living your life in the moment and also planning ahead for future needs that you might have? How to create a comfortable balance between those two things?
Well, I think the demarcation you're really, I think, kind of referring to in part is the fact that young people live within a comfortable cocoon that's the illusion of immortality. And some studies by Laura Carstensen have done a great job of showing that people who think they're going to live forever behave in one way, and people who know they have a limited amount of time left behave in a very different way. And some of Laura Carstensen's research really points us to the fact that it's one of the blessings of age, actually, to give up the idea that you're immortal, and that opens the door to a way of living that is actually much more centered, the way Martha was talking, much more centered, much more settled, actually in ways, some ways, much more enriching than the busy hubbub of youthful adulthood.
I would add that I think that that's precisely some of the good news about aging. And it ties to another important finding as well from social psychology that people now even refer to as the paradox of happiness or the U-shaped curve of happiness. That people start out around age 18 to 20 at a certain level of happiness, and that drops in the middle years and recovers around age 60. And if you look at a standard measure of happiness, so like on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you? People in their 70s score much higher than people in their 30s and 40s. So that there's this sense of, even though people have a burden of chronic disease and have experienced the kind of losses that we've been talking about, they're actually happier on a day-to-day basis. And precisely, you know, the reason for that is, or at least in part, is people learn to regulate their emotions better. They are able to have the highs be less high, lows be less low, and the limited time horizon Bill is mentioning helps to make you more selective. So, for example, these studies have found that even though older people have smaller social networks, they're actually happy with them than younger people are. And if I can use a scientific expression, basically they kick out all the jerks. You know, I mean, and they start to more selectively use their time. So I think they develop this kind of balance you're talking about. I mean, not everybody. But it's one of the positive aspects of aging, definitely.
They don't add any jerks to the top of the funnel.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Do not apply.
Right. Yes.
Stacy Sheldon, and I want to thank you for all your great comments. Some of them really hit home. I have two very specific questions. One dealing with long-term care. I know there are a lot of facilities where you can enter the facility as independent living and then have steps right on through to Alzheimer's. My concern is, who makes the decision on when you move from one step to another? Is that decision taken from you? Do you sign something in most places? And a second question, kind of separate. We talked about the quality of caregivers. There are some states that apparently rank much higher than others, and I wondered what the differences were in those states for elder care as to others. I think Rhode Island ranked very high. I can't remember the other two, but I wondered if it was just what we paid people or overall.
Well, actually, I've spent a little time on this question. So you're referring to something that would be called a CCRC, Continuing Care Retirement Community. And in the best of human and American ingenuity, it was thought that since aging is a down escalator, we'd put all the steps right next to each other, and somebody would get on at the top and go down to the bottom. It turns out that's not what aging is like, and it's not that simple. And as you were mentioning, people's needs change over time, and whether they would best be living in this environment or that environment. The problem with the continuing care retirement community is that it's premised on the notion that there's a conveyor belt and people will move across the conveyor belt. And what we find is people do not want to move across the conveyor belt. They want to stay in what they identify as their home. And this has led to some conflicts between the people living there and the business needs of the CCRC. So I couldn't say specifically about any given situation because it depends on what contracts have been signed and what agreements have been made. But generally, I have to say I'm not really a fan of continuing care retirement communities because I don't think they reflect a true vision of what the experience of aging really is. I really see them more as a relic of the 1970s and 80s kind of, and not really relevant today in my view. And your second question had to do with?
Which states?
States. So the list you're referring to, which came out recently, mentioned several New England states as doing a pretty good job. And among the states on the bottom were Texas, Oklahoma, and New York. Now, there's a reason why some of these states that don't do as well don't fare as well. And it has to do with a couple of things. One, large size. Nursing homes that are big are more likely to have problems than nursing homes that are small, generally speaking. So some of those smaller New England states have a lot of smaller nursing homes. Some big states have a lot of bigger nursing homes, and that skews the data a little bit. Secondly, I think that in New York State, I'll just say because it's my home state, there really hasn't been a lot of creative energy applied to figuring out what comes next. And if you look at the public policy, a lot of it's focused around maintaining the status quo, doing the annual inspections and not thinking about the future. And I think other states are doing a better job of that.
Did anyone want to weigh in on New York State?
I just add a small, hopefully it isn't too tangential. I think you raise another point, though, of really how difficult it is to be a consumer in this environment. But the Affordable Care Act, another good thing about it, is it's mandated more openness about long-term care data. And there are things on the line, online, like the Nursing Home Compare website, where you can look at the existence of survey data and compare. But it's a world; it's a topsy-turvy world. Long-term care, where consumer choice doesn't really weigh in, where you're sent to a nursing home by an anxious hospital discharge planner who wants to get the person somewhere. People can't really vote with their feet because once they're in, it's dangerous for them to leave because of the sort of transfer trauma. So it's really difficult in general to understand what the quality of the place that someone, you know, who's going into will actually be. So consumers have a lot of difficulty making those kinds of choices.
And just on the continuing care facilities, Bill. Mm-hmm. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you are seeing some innovations where community houses and greenhouses are being added to community care facilities.
Yes, actually, we are seeing some innovation there, and I think that's a good step. Ultimately, the United States of America, though, does have to wrestle with the fact that, you know, millions of older people are institutionalized, often against their will, and often for the remainder of their lives. And not too many people think that's a good idea, and yet it keeps happening. So I think what we're really faced with is what comes next. You know, what new models or new approaches is going to replace this legacy we have actually from the 1960s and 70s.
Mm-hmm. I'm Laura Beck. I work in the world of care, but I'm also a family member who, like Martha, was there to take care of some beloveds in my life. And I think, like so many families, we were sort of groping in the dark, really landing right in the middle of things, just as Martha pointed out so eloquently earlier. And I feel like I got lucky. I stumbled into the right place, but so very often, I don't feel like consumers are given the information they need to vote with their dollar, if you will. And I'm not just talking about what nursing home you go to or what assisted living you go to, but what home care you receive, et cetera. And I am an advocate, like I'm pretty sure everyone on this panel is, for person-centered or person-directed care. And I can pretty much guarantee you there are a lot of people out there who don't know that phraseology at all, or even what it means. And so as we see some more federal activity out there in terms of giving people motivation to do what's right in terms of offering care that puts the person first, I'm really curious and interested in seeing some local and regional dialogue going on so that consumers can feel more empowered and learn more about what to look for, what to demand, what to ask for, what to expect for themselves and for the people that they care for. So I'm just kind of curious if you guys want to pipe in on that.
Yeah, I definitely agree that one of the challenges is that family caregivers don't know where to go for information. You don't even know that you're a family caregiver. You may think that you're a husband or wife or partner or daughter, son, other family member. You don't think of yourself as a family caregiver, for one thing. So you don't know where to go for information. We have a wonderful Office for the Aging in this county, and most every other county of New York has a strong Office for the Aging, but people don't know that it exists. So you can't talk to their counselors about the options for services in your community unless you know that a counselor at the Office for the Aging is there to talk to you. I think that we need more funding for outreach services, flyers and doctor's offices and posters on the bus and radio advertisements, things that say you are a caregiver if you do the following for a loved one. You are a caregiver. And this is where you can go to find information and talk to people about what kind of care you want for yourself or your loved one. Whether it's person-centered care and you want to learn about that or you want to take a class maybe called Powerful Tools for Caregivers is a very popular class that's offered for care partners throughout the country, and your local Office for the Aging might be able to host that, or your local senior center could host that. So we need outreach and we need education to tell people that they're caregivers and that they can find information in their communities.
Anyone else?
I would add that picking up on both Martha's and Laura's comments, there's a paradox here, which is that the dissatisfaction many people have had with care and the feeling that it's care's not good and what are we going to do and there's nothing we can do, that sense of hopelessness actually perpetuates bad care. We would all be much better off if we were able to judge care effectively, and it's hard to do, and a lot of times people feel they're not qualified or not sure. And I'll give one tip that I think is really useful, and it picks up on what Laura was saying. Bad care puts tasks ahead of people. when you see care where the caregivers are focused on the task that has to be done, feeding, bathing, dressing, where their focus is on the task and not the person, it's, if it's not bad right now, it's going to be bad. When you see care where the focus is on the person and then the tasks are part of that, but they're not the center focus, you tend to get much better care, higher quality care. Really, care is about a relationship first and tasks second.
And I would add, too, if I could wave a magic wand to have just one thing happened, it would be some kind of one-stop shopping for the coordination of care. To share a personal anecdote, I come from an extended family with brothers and spouses who include two physicians, two people who work in gerontology, geriatrics research, a clinical psychologist, and my mother was ill, and we had no idea what to do. It was really, there's no protection being in this field to be able to untangle the whole set of issues of what a person's eligible for and what they aren't eligible for and how to think about protecting assets and how to find resources of varying quality. And the offices for the aging do a great job, but that function, if there could be some way to provide the kinds of resources that people can afford it, get through private case management. I think there are lots of people who wind up in nursing homes because they don't have that special kind of individualized attention to their own care needs. So we really do have a system that's almost impossible to negotiate as a caregiver, even if you have a lot of expertise in it. And if we could do something about that regionally or nationally, I think it would make a big difference.
I'd like to pick up on that. The AARP in New York recently did a survey of thousands of caregivers in New York State, and the number one type of support that family caregivers said they needed is a free case manager or counselor who could help them figure out what resources were available in their community and figure out a care plan that would suit their particular family. Kind of like a geriatric care manager, but either free or extremely affordable. That was their number one need. Their second was respite. The third was training on how to do medical tasks when their loved one comes home from the hospital and they need the caregiver needs to administer shots or bandage wounds or manage medication to have training to do those tasks that used to be done by nurses at home.
We'll take one more question and then we need to wrap up.
Thanks for a fascinating discussion. I appreciate hearing what you've had to say. You mentioned the conversation before the conversation. I'd like to talk about actions before the care, or part of early caring, perhaps, maintaining one's health, maintaining one's ability to put people in the tunnel, the funnel. And that's exercise, socializing opportunities for associating with one another and using our public spaces. You know, I spent 25 years designing children's playgrounds, and we're very good at creating places for younger people to get outdoors and exercise, even though they don't know that's what they're doing, and socializing in a sort of lighthearted, playful manner. We don't do such a good job at all, and I'm hoping that boomers, we will be demanding these opportunities. So perhaps you could weigh in on what our city and town and village planners can do to encourage better use of the public spaces that we have for recreation, for lighthearted, playful recreation, and socializing, and getting the exercise that'll help us not age in place, but wherever we age, do it in a way that we can keep some independence.
I'd just actually start by saying, picking up on your comment, if I had to teach a course in gerontology and I've only had like 30 seconds, the one thing I would teach is use it or lose it. And the virtue of a built environment that encourages physical activity and exertion and socialization, all those things that you might enjoy at whatever stage of life you're in now. If you want to have them 3 decades from now, you have to use them. And as we get older in particular, things we stop doing, we discover we can't do. And that tends to limit horizons and damages well-being. So I guess my plea is to say about local decision makers is how do we create really walkable environments, strong sense of community, sense of reciprocity, where older people are a normal and actually well-embraced part of daily life for people of all ages. That's what I'd like to see.
Yeah, I would add, if you look at the research over the last 10 to 15 years on physical exercise and its relationship to every dimension of health, if there were a pharmaceutical company that had bottled that and sold it, it would be probably the most valuable company on earth. I mean, it's really every system, every aspect of it is so greatly improved by physical exercise and even moderate amounts of it that, you know, it's really stunning. On the local level, there's been funding by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, other places around healthy communities that do show that small changes do make a difference, like improving lighting so people can walk somewhere in the evening, improving access to parks, definitely creating a situation where it's easier for older people to walk to them and to walk in their own communities. There is kind of a technology around this that if local communities here wanted to get into, I think, you know, they would be able to. But I think the concept of these kinds of spaces that we do for children, I mean, not infantilizing older people, but thinking about the special needs of older people, you know, often for older people, having an element of community, of people exercising and doing things together is important. So it's also creating the social environment for it. But, you know, rates of physical activity still for people 65 and over are dismally low. It's only about a third of people 65 to 75 meet physical activity requirements, and only about a quarter of people 75 and over. So it really is causing a massive amount of excess disability. And to the extent that these environmental modifications can make a difference, they're worth every penny. I mean, so I definitely agree.
Thank you. We'll all walk home now or or get on our treadmill when we get there.
I don't know. There are cookies back there.
Yeah. Bike somewhere. That's excellent. Well, and I don't know about all of you, but I feel much better knowing that even the experts don't always know what to do when the situations present themselves in your family. So that concludes our forum on elder care. I want to thank our panelists, Dr. Carl Pillemer of Cornell University, Dr. Bill Thomas, founder of the Eden Alternative, and Martha Stantinius, caregiver, advocate, and author. Thanks also to producer and engineer Mark Lavonier, to Lorraine Rapp for helping organize this forum, and to Leah Landry for web and graphics support. And special thanks to the Tompkins County Public Library for hosting us here, and also to Lisa Holmes at the Tompkins County Office of Aging. This is the latest in a series of community forums on health topics, which WRVO Public Media is holding throughout our listening region. These forums are sponsored by the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. I'm Catherine Loper. Thank you for joining this discussion on WRVO Public Media.